1 million Irish men and women died during the potato blight of the 1840s. Thomas Francis Marr survived, only to be imprisoned by the British rulers he fought against. He eventually ended up in America, where he became an American Civil War general, governor of the Montana Territory, and one of the best-known Irishmen of his day. Timothy Egan explores his story in his best-selling book, The Immortal Irishman, and what it took for Irish immigrants to make a new Ireland for themselves in the New World. Tim, what did you discover about Thomas Francis Marr that made you want to write a book about him?
Because you see almost the entire Irish-American story in one man's life. He starts out with the famine, the great, devastating, the singular crime of Britain, where you mentioned 1 million people starved to death, another 1 million were forced to leave. And these barefoot peasants who'd never been more than 30 miles from their village, they wash ashore in the United States.
And that's a good percent of the entire population.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Means basically one in four were called out of Ireland. Then he's sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit for his role in advocating, you know, an independent Ireland. His sentence is commuted at the last minute, and he's sentenced to life imprisonment in Tasmania, which is full of Irish refugees. They took orphans off the street, and they put all the political prisoners on Tasmania.
So 1840s, he's sent on a prison ship all the way to Tasmania.
It's the smartest, most eloquent, he's totally very well-educated writer, are all in this one godforsaken to them.
Must have been a terrible voyage.
They thought it was
voyage.
Beautiful, but they felt so far away. They felt like they'd dropped off the earth.
Right.
He escapes from Tasmania and comes to the United States at the very point where we're having peak immigration. So he experiences that. Then we have our Civil War, and some of the Irish join the South because they're afraid all these freed slaves will take their crappy jobs. But he founds the Irish Brigade and fights in all the major wars of the Civil War and elevates the image that Americans have of Irishmen because of their valor, because of their bravery. They were in all the major battles of the Civil War and had the second highest casualty rate of any other regiments. And finally, he ends up as the first governor of territorial Montana. And he dies at the age of 46. So all of those episodes, any one of which could be one man's life, are in this person's life.
What a life.
Yeah.
When you don't even have modern things that we take for granted to enhance your life. I mean,
exactly.
Just to go from one continent to the other was
right.
Like an epic journey.
Exactly.
Now, let's just talk about the context here in Ireland, mid-19th century, 1840s and so on. At this time, I understand Dublin was like a respected partner to London, the second city of the British Empire.
Well, that's the image the British would give you because they had this thing called the Act of Union, which was a forced union with Ireland had to join Britain. They were determined for almost 800 years to make the Irish English. And so they'd passed a series of horrible laws, the penal laws, just basically out, tried to erase all ethnicity. The statutes of Kilkenny made it a crime to have to ride the wrong kind of a horse. If a horse was worth more than 5 pounds, you could be imprisoned. Even the Irish grave was regulated. So the Brits had done everything they could.
So they've planted Protestants up in the most Catholic part of the island,
in
up
the, north.
In the north.
Exactly.
And ironically,
and kick people out of their homes.
So the most Catholic part becomes what we think of as the indigenous Protestant part, but it wasn't.
That was
created by London.
And that's why you still have tensions today, because it was called the Plantation of Ireland, was what it was called. But now, the context of Marr is that it's the Victorian age. He's very well educated. He's from Waterford. He's a prince of Waterford. He's a good-looking guy. He speaks five languages.
So he's kind of a Catholic elite.
He comes from a wealthy family.
Yeah.
Most of the Catholics are starving. It's a Catholic-majority country. But he has this life ahead of him that could be just easy, go to the club. And then the famine hits, and it radicalizes everyone because they see this massive crime. They see food leaving Irish ports. And Marr's cry was, let Irish food raised by Irish hands go into Irish mouths. Great Britain, which was then had the largest empire on earth, one quarter of the world's landmass had the Union Jack flying over it. And the most troublesome part of this vast empire was 30 miles away.
Right there on their doorstep.
There. Also, this is the place where they were exporting more food per capita than any other place in the British Empire. While people are starving to death, while little children are chewing dandelions, while they're replacing the bottoms of coffins. So it radicalizes this Victorian gentleman, young Thomas Francis Marr, and he helps to lead the 1848 rebellion.
Tim, when we talk about the Irish famine, I grew up thinking, oh, the potato crop failed and these poor Irish people starved. That's the kind of comfortable view of the famine, but there really was an insidious sort of structure behind it, and the English knew that there was more than enough food there and they just wanted to grow food for export.
They now recognize it in Britain, at least the government has, that this was a crime and it was also they didn't have this word then, but it was genocide.
Did the Irish people know it at the time, or was the thought was this is an act of God and all of our people?
Well,
died.
In Britain, they said it was an act of God. They said that the Irish families were too big, and this was a benevolent God culling the population.
Yeah.
They said that, and they let them starve. They didn't, in some cases, didn't let food land in the ports. The Cherokee Nation were among the people who sent food to the Irish during the famine. And for a time, that ship bound with Cherokee Nation corn could not land in Dublin Harbor. And I was on a panel once where people said, oh, you dumb Irish, how come all you ate was potatoes? Don't you know it's a monoculture? Like, we're so stupid, all we could do is just eat potatoes. Well, in fact, a family could feed itself on a single acre of potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
But what happened was when the potato crop failed, all these other crops were around, the Brits were systematically exporting them. I should say also that this is the kind of history that you can feel, touch, and see when you go to Ireland. One of the things that really moved me to tears, and maybe it's because I'm a sentimental Irishman, was seeing a famine village in the west of Ireland, not far from Dingle.
Yeah.
It was basically these little rock huts, and you can go in and see where the fire, the earthen floor, and where people tried to boil their potatoes. And you can see the burial plot out back where, you know, you had to bury half of your family. And everyone then walked to the port to go to America.
I think I know where you are. These skeletal buildings. They just are haunted with hunger, and they're just stones. You look through the window and you see the sky. And then up on the high, on the slopes, you see the corduroy pattern.
You do.
Of the plowed lines where they planted the potatoes and they never were harvested.
Exactly. And it's really stirring because you feel the heartbreak, you feel the hunger, you feel the... And I admire the courage of those people who again, had never gone, most of them had never even gone to Dublin, if you live in the West of Ireland. Suddenly, they're going to get on what's called a coffin ship because one in five Irish would not make the journey alive.
Timothy Egan is introducing us to a notable 19th century Irish American right now on Travel with Rick Steves. He writes about the legacy of Thomas Francis Marr in his 2016 bestseller, The Immortal Irishman. Tim's also authored A Pilgrimage to Eternity. It's about what he discovered about himself and his Catholic upbringing while traveling the medieval pilgrim trail from Canterbury to Rome. His latest title is Fever in the Heartland: The Ku Klux Klan's Plot to Take Over America and the Woman Who Stopped Them. His website is timothyeganbooks.com. So this is the chance for you to take all of this tumultuous story of the Irish people and weave it in to the life of Thomas Francis Marr. And Thomas Francis Marr could have just kept it easy with his rich father in Waterford, where they make that beautiful Waterford crystal, or he could get radicalized. And he was a leader in a group called the Young Irelanders, fighting the Act of Union?
Yes, exactly.
He went to France in 1848 to actually learn from one of those revolutions.
And to try to enlist the help of the French as well. They ultimately didn't help. But an important thing that happened after that is he brought home the idea for the Irish flag. And so it was orange on one side, green on the other, and white in the middle, signifying the union of the orange and the green.
So that would be the Protestant English and the Catholic Irish?
Exactly, because they believed in a unified Ireland, that we could all live together, but they could self-govern. That was the key thing. They weren't allowed to self-govern themselves. So today, Waterford, Thomas Marr's home, has this great plaque that says, Home of the Man Who Gave Ireland Its Flag. I mean, they'd celebrate Marr for many reasons, because he's their favorite son. And when John F. Kennedy went to Ireland in 1963 and spoke to the Irish Parliament, what was one of the stories he told? It was of the Irish Brigade that Thomas Francis Marr had led during the Civil War.
Okay, so he's banished for his political activity against London, sent to Tasmania. He actually escapes, and then he has quite a life in America.
Yeah, so he gets his hero's welcome when he comes ashore in New York City. Remember, all these immigrants are coming ashore in Philadelphia, Boston, and New York. And there's also a counter movement to that, which was the Know-Nothing movement. They thought these people were criminals. We get these words like paddy wagon. They were the second biggest political party in 1854.
And so we got interesting parallels today.
Well, that's exactly why you're right. That's why we love history. We hear the echoes of history. And what I heard a lot of in the anti-immigration stuff of the modern day was the echoes of the Know-Nothing Party. But so when Marr comes ashore, he's rallying these poor Irish who, again, are living in these crowded tenements. They're not having good lives. They are filling the jails. Again, I mentioned the term paddy wagon. Hooligan was another word that was created in the United States that came about because of...
Hooligan. That's just like a Jones
or
something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, so I'm not going to gloss it over. They were poor and a lot of them were criminal. Marr rallies them and says, you can have a greater cause. And what is that greater cause? It's fighting the slaveholders in the South when the Civil War comes.
New York Times columnist Timothy Egan is telling us about the remarkable story of Irish immigrant Thomas Francis Marr, which he writes about in his book, The Immortal Irishman. Joshua is listening in from Bow in New Hampshire and joins us on the line at 877-333-7425.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Tim. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Have you had some thoughts about this sort of Irish diaspora and the impact Irishmen had in the United States?
Well, actually, yes. I'm interested in Thomas Marr because I'm a history teacher here in New Hampshire. And every year in April, I take a group with some other teachers on a Civil War-themed trip. And we always go to Antietam. Mm-hmm. And I have family from Ireland, from County Kerry, on the Ring of Kerry. So I've always been interested in the Irish and their contributions to our country. But going on this trip at Antietam has made me wonder that not many Americans knew about the Irish Brigade and the contributions of the Irish to our Civil War and our history. And I'm wondering, to what extent today do the Irish understand and celebrate their contributions to our Civil War?
First of all, thank you for doing this, because Rick and I are both big believers in history and we want to keep our stories alive, and it's important that we do this. Antietam, as you know, was the site of the worst casualties in the history of America. We never had had a greater loss of life than that one single day in Antietam. I also think Fredericksburg is important, and this gets to your question. Fredericksburg was where the Irish Brigade, there was 100,000 Confederates up on the hill and 100,000 Union members down below. The job was to go up the hill and try to take the hill from them. And they sent the Irish Brigade as the spear of all the other soldiers. Marr knew it was going to be a slaughter, but he told his men, his brigade, to put a little sprig of green under their caps. And they had them all pick the little sprig of green. He says, when they roll our bodies over them, they'll know we died as Irishmen. And it was an utter slaughter. It broke Marr because he had personally recruited most of these boys. He knew their families. He knew where they came from. He knew what it meant for them. And they were just mowed down. And when they turned those bodies over, they found those sprigs of green. It's very moving. I mentioned John F. Kennedy, first Irish-American president, and that's the story. That's the specific story, and it goes to your question, do the Irish know this? When he spoke to the Irish Parliament, this is the story that JFK told them.
Knowing it would resonate with them.
Exactly. The story of the boys who put the sprigs of green under their caps.
That's good that Ireland is aware of that, because that is some pretty impressive heroism for an immigrant community.
Exactly.
Joshua, thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks, Tim.
Take care. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Tim Egan. His book is The Immortal Irishman. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. And Judy's calling from Seattle. Do you have a thought about Irish immigration and the impact Ireland has had on the world?
Yes, I've been enjoying the conversation. And Irish immigration brings to mind for me as one of the great labor heroes. I come from a labor family. And I don't know if you're familiar with the history of Mother Jones, Mary Harris Jones. She was a great labor leader, and unlike some of the martyrs Mr. Egan was talking about, she lived to a ripe old age, but in the meantime, she caused a lot of havoc. Are you familiar with her, or is Mr. Egan?
Well, I'm familiar with her as her place in history. I don't know her story very well, her deep story.
Well, there are several books about her, but I just think she should be included in the pantheon of the country women who came and engaged in the struggle for workers' rights. She founded the Social Democratic Party, and she helped establish the Industrial Workers of the World, which is still a major force today. And I was wondering if you would ever conceive of writing about her.
There's so many great ghosts out there to chase down.
I'll tell
you what, I'll make you a promise here on the air. I will look into her story because I only know her as, you know, kind of a bold-faced name of history.
Right.
And I'm starting to research some early parts of the 20th century, and she's popping up quite a bit.
Judy, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Tim, I want to just take a moment to talk about where you traveled in Ireland to put this book together, because anybody who's fascinated by history in Ireland has an amazing story. When you travel, the land just speaks to you. What were some of the places you went to that really had a very rewarding impact in your work?
This truly, as an Irish American, my family's from County Waterford, where Marr's from as well, was one of the most gratifying things I'd ever done. You go to Ireland, you go to hear trad music, you eat fresh food in the West. People are friendly, but they really know their history. Cab drivers will tell you about Daniel O'Connell, the Liberator, or I'll tell you something about the Great Famine. They really know their history. Ireland also, as you know, some of the main places that a visitor goes to in Ireland are shrines to martyrdom or awfulness or misery. And, you know, much of Irish history, most of Irish history is misery. I always say,
tough story.
We wouldn't be Irish without our, you know, misery is our currency. So one of the most extraordinary places I went was Kilmainham Jail in Dublin. Mm-hmm. Now, the castle, which is still there and the most prominent tourist site in Ireland or in Dublin, is where the British aristocracy, the British military, they had a larger garrison in Ireland than they ever had in India. So they always had at least 10,000 soldiers there. The castle represented everything about occupation they didn't like.
And the castle is right there in downtown.
It is right there in downtown. Like, and you can go in, walk around, see all those.
This is British colonial.
Nearby, about a mile or so away, is the jail they built, Kilmainham Jail. Only when I sat in one of the cells and looked out at the limestone, I remember Mar once saying that it seemed that the stone themselves were weeping because Ireland is such a misty, wet place. And the limestone tends to be porous. I sat in Mar's cell and awaiting death, he dashed off this poetry and all these letters. He was such an effervescent, you know, he was 24 years old. So to go to Kilmainham Jail is quite extraordinary. And then I urge people to go to Waterford. It's often not visited. It's worth a day or two. It's Mar's town and it's on the river. It's glorious.
This is the southeast corner of Ireland.
Southeast corner of Ireland. And Mar's home is now the Granville Hotel. Mm-hmm. And it has, I think, 5 or 7 rooms in there. They're all, but you could see the life of luxury he had, the tapestry. You can go to the museum. The same statue that started my journey, Rick, I was in Helena, Montana many years ago, and there's this giant equestrian statue of an Irishman with these words of sedition written at the base. And I said to the governor, hey, who's the guy on the horse? And he says, you call yourself an Irish American and you don't know who Thomas Francis Marr is? That same statue is in Waterford now.
Okay.
So they put it up. And you see these giant banners that now say, welcome to Waterford, home of Thomas Francis Marr.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Tim Egan, and his book is The Immortal Irishman, the Irish revolutionary who became an American hero. Tim, if we just wrap it up, how might we draw inspiration from the history that you share in your book?
Well, you know, history sort of echoes around different eras. It goes quiet for a while, and then it reappears. And I think in the present moment in the United States that we're living through, you see so much of the stuff that Marr fought for. The basic concept of immigrants being able to become Americans. How did they become Americans in this country? They fought and died, and that truly made them. But they had to fight horrible prejudice. All the things you hear people say about certain members of society today were said about the first great wave of immigrants, which were the Irish. Also, the pure power of resilience. I wrote a book about the Dust Bowl as well, and it strikes me that the parallels to the famine, that these are tragedies, and the famine was a horrible tragedy, and it lives deep in our bones right now, but it's also the tale of the human spirit and the resilience. I'm here today talking to you because my old man, I mean, my great-great-grandfather, I'm famine Irish on my father's side. Somebody got up and walked with bare feet to come through here.
And you've taken the initiative to learn about it and to share it. Tim Egan, thank you so much, and look forward to future work of yours.
Thank you.
Tim Egan explores the Irish immigration to the U.S. and Australia in a website extra to today's show. You can hear it at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, find out how you can feel Irish history all around you on the windblown Aran Islands. We're at 877-333-RICK.